Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week,
I went to go and speak to my sister who was with me the night before, and she said, what happened last night? And I was like, well, I was going to ask you the same thing.
So few will be able to think of a crime where the victim is forced to take on that level of responsibility of thought, if you like, mm-hmm. without any level of support, as you mentioned.
I still got a scar on my chin from the night I got spiked. I could get quite angry when I thought about it, because I thought that person that did that to me is just probably just going about their life in a normal way, and I'm having to suffer with these injuries.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday. The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. Thank you for your time. What a week it's been. Really busy from my point of view. And I've got hopefully some good news coming up over the next couple of weeks about the successes of the Football Untold podcast that I've been working on, which was about problem gambling within football, but with a view to helping people outside of football get support. So I'll have a little bit of news for you, hopefully, around that. You can also check that out via footballuntold.co.uk or where you get your podcasts. Something of a Mental Health Monday production, that. This week on the podcast, I'm going to bring a conversation to your ears, hopefully, which relates to an investigation I've been working on as part of my regular day job as senior news editor for the Bauer Media Group, radio stations like Greatest Hits Radio and Kiss and Magic and Absolute and Hits and stations like that. I've been focusing on for the last few months hearing stories about spiking and the impact of spiking, what it does to you, how it impacts people, who's doing it, why they're doing it, and of course, how we stop it. And I had a really, really interesting conversation with a campaigner called Maya Howells. And Maya sets out her story and what happened to her and what her campaign is about. And I'm bringing this to the mental health world because it's one of those things which spiking, when you think about it now, it's almost just an accepted or normalized risk that people face within their social lives. And it strikes me as very odd that we as a society have normalized it in the way that we have, that people, you know, have to worry about covering their drinks, that people think about having to keep their drinks with them at all times for fear that someone will spike their drink, put something into their drink, and then do it for whatever reason, to take advantage of someone, to sexually harass someone, to sexually assault someone, or, concerningly as well, that they do it for banter because they think it's just a bit of a laugh. And yet, this is a common threat that people have to face, particularly women. So I've been doing quite a lot of research around this field. I'm speaking to a lot of people, but Maya's story, I think, sums it up really, really well. 5,000 people last year reported being spiked to the police. That's 5,000 people, victims of crime. But actually, when you delve a little bit deeper and you look at the number of people who reported spikings to the police, fewer than 1 in 10, potentially even 1 in 20 cases, only ever get reported to the police. So it's actually a massively underreported problem. And actually, as part of that conversation there, you've got tens of thousands of people every year who are victims of crime, who basically feel like they have to accept it. And when you widen that out across the society and you look at the figures again, 11% of women have been spiked. So that's one in nine, one in 10 women have been spiked. It's around about 6% of men. 43% of women, by the way, have either been spiked or know someone who has. So it just goes to show this is a really common thing that's happening. People who've gone through traumatic experiences, people who have been potentially assaulted, as I've been hearing as part of my investigation, people have been sexually harassed. Some people as well don't even know what happened to them as a result of their spike. And of course, that brings with it its own trauma, physical injuries that come with it, as well as we'll hear from Maya. Now, there's a lot of campaigning around this. The Stamp Out Spiking Group are doing a lot around this. I've Been Spiked are doing a lot around this. And I'll put a link to where you can find out some more information in the podcast notes as well. But, you know, why should we be accepting that people should have to experience a crime and then just live with it? Well, the simple answer is we shouldn't have to accept that. And if you speak to the police, they will say, absolutely, it should be reported. But there's so much more complexity around this issue. And I think those issues of trauma, almost post-traumatic stress, you know, can really play an impact on people's mental health. I heard one story of an individual who can't even walk past the club where she was targeted during the day because it's too triggering because of that experience. And like I say, I want to bring you this conversation because it summarizes a lot of these points and the impact that it can have on people. And of course, the fact that there are steps that we could potentially take to change things up. Now, I'll put an article as well within this podcast notes, which has a government response. Now, of course, the government think that spiking is an appalling crime. And they say they're putting investment into that. There's the full statement on the podcast as well. They have rejected the idea of bringing about a specific offence for spiking, instead relying on the laws from 1861 Offences Against the Persons Act, which they say covers off everything the police need to tackle this crime. So there's no need for a specific law. But the details of that are in the article. I'd urge you to look at that as well so you can get a heads up as to sort of where things are at from a campaigning point of view. But here's the conversation. Maya sets this out in such a normal way. And I want to stress the word normal there, that this is just people going about their lives, being targeted by offenders, being targeted by a criminal, and then having to just go on with their lives. Of course, there are ramifications for that.
It was February in 2020, and I was going out for a mate's birthday party at a club that I'd been to so many times, and I live really near it. So I wasn't, to be honest, during the day, I wasn't really thinking much of the night at hand. It was just like a standard night up until, well, from what I can remember, we all got together and then we went to the club. And before I'd got there, I hadn't really drank very much. I'd had like one beer at home, and then we left to go. And I remember like everything about getting into the club, what it was like, what music was playing. And when we got there, I went to the bar to buy some drinks. They had one of those high card limits at the bar, so I had to buy three drinks rather than just one for myself. So I bought two for my mates and I passed them back. And then I took one sip of that drink. And after that point, I don't remember anything up until waking up in my bed the next day.
I mean, waking up the next morning, presumably it was you thinking, oh, what happened there? At what point did you think, hang on a minute, what I've lost a period of time from taking a sip of a drink to now? At what point did it start to dawn on you that something had occurred in that moment just before you'd taken that sip?
It was a weird one, because when I woke up in the morning, I had all of these injuries and I was really confused. I woke up and I still had my clothes on from the night before. Luckily, I woke up in my own bed. I still had all my clothes on from the night before, which is so unlike me. And I've never blacked out from alcohol. So I was confused, but weirdly, the first thing that I did was kind of blame myself in a way. I was like, well, something must have happened. I must have done this. Like, and I think now looking back on it, it was kind of a way of taking back control because I was probably quite frightened. I went to go and speak to my sister who was with me the night before, and she said, what happened last night? And I was like, well, I was going to ask you the same thing. I realized that, you know, I'd split my chin, and I later found out I'd fractured my wrist, but I knew that my wrist really hurt and my nose, I was bleeding from my nose. So my first point of call was to go to A&E to get those injuries treated. At this point, it kind of hadn't really set in that maybe something more sinister had happened. It was only when I got to A&E, and it was before COVID, so you had to go to hospital by yourself. So I had a lot of time to sit there and just think, I suppose. I kind of felt quite numb. And then I eventually saw the nurse. And when I saw her, she said, you know, all of your injuries suggest that you've been spiked. Before, and I know how horrible it is. And I think at that point I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense, because before it was just me trying to piece together something and just blaming myself for something that was so out of my control. And she said, you know, it's too late to run any tests, which I knew because I've been in A&E for about 5 hours. And Just 2 months before I got spiked, my sister had been spiked. So I knew the process of like going to A&E and getting tested and like what they needed from you. So I knew that that was kind of out of the question. So I kind of had my physical injuries treated and then I left and I had no follow-up support or anything. And that's kind of when I went online to kind of find answers, I suppose.
So your sister had been spiked, you'd been spiked, and you got a greater understanding of that because the nurse who was treating you had also been spiked. One of the things we're trying to do as part of this sort of project is to highlight just how common an issue it is, particularly among women. And I guess your story sort of tells that side of the story really, really well, because everyone in and around that story that you've mentioned so far has had the same thing happen to them. This terrible event, which creates these big unknowns, and in your case ended with you with a trip to A&E.
Yeah, I think that was something that kind of blew my mind in a way, because I was like, well, my sister's been spiked 2 months before me. This nurse that just so happened to see me out of all the nurses working that day had also been spiked. I've been spiked, and before that point, I knew about spiking. It was something that I was aware of. But just until it happened to my sister, I didn't know anyone knowingly that it happened to, right? And then suddenly it just started to appear so much around me. And I guess that's kind of why I decided that I wanted to do something about that.
What can you tell us about sort of what you're now aware of where you were that night, what you were like in the club, where people had tracked you down, where potentially you'd got the injuries? How much do you know about that period, or what have you been told about that period that gives you a sense of filling in some of those blanks?
So I guess some parts of the night are still completely murky, and those blanks will never be filled in, unfortunately. But from what I know, my sister lost me and she went to go and look for me because she wanted to come home. And she was looking for me, you know, around this club, couldn't find me anywhere, checked every single like nook and crevice, you know, of this club. And the only place that she wasn't able to check was the boys' toilet. So she got a guy to go in there. And he said, you know, the end cubicle is locked. It's been locked for a while. And so my sister just went into the toilets, knocked on the door. And eventually, apparently I opened it, at which point I'd already sustained all my physical injuries because I was covered in blood. And I think I was like incoherent, basically. I couldn't really explain what happened. I think I was trying to say something like, you know, someone's drugged me or something like that, but it was all a bit murky. And then my sister managed to take me home because we happened to live so close to the club. So my sister was able to take me home. But yeah, other parts of that night are completely lost. My mum ended up contacting the venue to view the CCTV. And finally, they responded and they let her go there. I didn't want to go because I think at that point it was a bit too raw for me. I didn't want to see any of that night or repeat it. My mum went to go and see the CCTV and, you know, one of the most critical cameras for any business, I suppose, in many different ways, especially in like the nightlife industry, is the one that's behind the bar. That would have been where we would have been able to see when my drink was spiked and who by. But also in a business way, you know, if someone's taking alcohol, taking money from behind the till, like it's really important. That camera was unfortunately blocked by fairy lights. So she couldn't see anything out of that. But she did see the camera from the stairs of the nightclub. And she said, we went down the stairs and I recognized you as my daughter. And when you came back up, I didn't know who that was. It was like you were just moving completely differently. Because obviously there's not much you can see from CCTV, but she was like, even the way you were moving was just completely out of the ordinary. So those are the only gaps that I kind of have filled in, but there's a massive section of the night, I'd say about space of half an hour or the time that I sustained those injuries, that no one saw anything from what I know. No one helped. You know, even security at the club, like even my sister carried me out of the venue. My sister's younger than me. And I'm a lot taller as well. And she had to carry me out of venue, and not once did someone stop her to help or security get involved. So to this day, I still feel like it was not managed in the best way. You know, the incident happened that shouldn't have happened, but it should have been managed better afterwards, I believe.
In terms of the, if you don't mind me asking, in terms of the injuries and where you were found, what are your feelings towards that? Obviously, you were in a sort of a locked cubicle. So maybe there was some sort of self-preservation thing had kicked in that had made you do that. What are your feelings around that thing of having injuries that you don't understand and also finding yourself in a place where you'd physically know you would never have gone if you'd have had your wits about you? What are your feelings around your vulnerabilities, I guess?
Yeah.
At around that time, particularly when there's such lack of knowledge around the reasons why you were there and how those injuries came about.
I mean, I think after the incident, like it when it was still really fresh, I had so many questions, and I had to think about it and sit and think with my feelings. And there's so many things that could have happened in that situation, and I guess I had to let go of not knowing, because I feel like it would have kept me up at night, you know, thinking about all of the possible scenarios, like, was I sexually assaulted? Was I sexually harassed? Like, I still don't know. One of the first questions that the nurse asked me was, do I think I've been raped? And I think that was the only point where I started like crying, because I was like, I actually genuinely don't know. Just quite dark. So I guess the narrative that I've kind of had to tell myself is that I fell and I pulled myself to the toilet for safety, but I still don't know whether that's true or not. And that's something that I have to live with. And, you know, I still got a scar on my chin from the night I got spiked. I see that every day. When it just happened, you know, I was dealing with those physical consequences of having a fractured wrist, you know, having stitches in my chin, and I could get quite angry when I thought about it, because I thought that person that did that to me is just probably just going about their life in a normal way and I'm having to suffer with these injuries. But I think I learned to let go, because it's not going to change what happened, so the best way to move forward is to take back control, mainly through campaigning, I suppose.
And thank you for answering that question, Maya, and I really appreciate it. And the reason I ask it is because I think for our audiences, I think there's not so few will be able to think of a crime where the victim is forced to take on that level of responsibility of thought, if you like, mm-hmm. without any level of support, as you mentioned, without somebody in the club coming to help support or having to rely on a, you know, a sibling, the younger sibling to carry them out. That there isn't a wraparound system, let's call it a protocol that kicks into place when someone is spotted in a particular state, that then a safety, a public health service kicks in, and instead you're having to deal with those thoughts of what, you know, what happened, we don't really know. Whereas in most other things, there's almost a collective responsibility comes around individuals who are in a difficult place, particularly when they're in a public space. As well. And I wonder, first, from a licensing point of view, that idea of a safety protocol, it sounds to me very much like something should have kicked in. There should have been some flag that should have gone up at some point from the state that you'd found yourself in.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's so many things at so many different levels that should take place when it comes to spiking. The moment that, you know, there is, I don't like to put a lot of onus on this, but like, there is a bit of collective responsibility when you see someone that's in that state. As your peer group, people should know how to respond in that situation. What I've come to realize is people don't know how to respond, or people will see someone and they just think, oh, they're really drunk. You know, in some cases people take the piss a bit, but it's like, we should actually be helping these people and making sure that, you know, even if they are too drunk, they are in a vulnerable situation. So we should be taking care of that. I think once you realize that someone maybe has been spiked or something more sinister has happened, we should have access to testing immediately. I think a lot of, you know, the police won't investigate unless you have a blood test or a urine test that proves that you've been spiked. If you just say to the police, I've been spiked, they don't want to hear it, unfortunately. So it's kind of your words against theirs. They won't investigate further. So if they won't investigate without the testing, we need to make the testing more readily available, you know. And I kind of, when my sister got spiked, my mum called the police. The police sent her to A&E. She went to A&E. And they said, you know, we don't do forensic testing here. I'm so sorry. My mum went back to the police and they said, we're not going to investigate further. So a lot of the time victims are being ping-ponged between services and no one kind of wants to take responsibility. And then also on that night, I think what would have helped me is just someone in charge, like security or whatever, helping. I'm still to this day kind of confused how I was able to walk out of a venue, you know, bleeding from my nose and my mouth, my sister carrying me, and not a single security guard offered to help. You know, they have a duty of care to people on their premises, or even like a bar manager or someone, you know. But I think about times where one of my friends has been a bit drunk before getting into a club, and they haven't even been allowed to step foot in the club. But I was allowed to leave the club in that state, you know. I don't understand how that's even possible. So I think there's like a lot of things at a lot of different levels, you know, licensing and stuff like that, and getting policies rolled out within the nighttime industry that help bars and clubs to manage it. And it should be a set policy that every single bar and club and pub should have. So, you know, there's like policy about bringing drugs into a club. There's policy about bringing weapons into a club. It should be the same with spiking. That everyone has to adhere to in order to keep their license. And then it would be nice to see more active support from the police and coherence between them and the hospital crew and ambulance crew. But yeah, there's a few things that I think we need to change in order to make these situations better.
But the experience of your sister meant that you thought, well, there's no, even though you knew you'd been the victim of a crime that had ended up with you in hospital, you thought, well, there's no point contacting the police, which I guess is a sign of where we're at with spiking at the moment, that you having experienced that and knowing other people who had, including the nurse, but still to think, well, actually it's not worth me contacting the police, whose job is ultimately to protect and serve the public.
It's honestly such a shame now that I look back on it, because I wish that I would have reported it. But I literally thought at that moment, what is the point? You know, even though I had sustained physical injuries, luckily my sister hadn't. But I had physical injuries, but I just thought, you know, that day was so painful to think about putting myself through that. And like, it wasn't offered to me at the hospital. Like, no one suggested that, you know, maybe I should report it. Maybe if I would have had the push to do so, maybe I would have. And I look back on it, I think that's one of my regrets, is that I wish I would have pushed a bit further. But I still, even though I do regret not reporting it, I still don't think it would have done very much, which is a shame. And I think from a lot of the victims that I speak to, it's a collective feeling. You know, how traumatizing is it to speak about what happened to you? Sometimes people just want to forget it. Sometimes people don't even know whether they've been spiked and whether it's worth reporting. But collectively, I think a lot of people, especially young women, don't have very much trust in the police. So that's kind of the last place that we want to go. It would be good if there was a middleman, you know. So yeah, I think I wish I would have reported, but I kind of knew that nothing would come from it, so I didn't.
And in terms of that sort of wider issue now, the work you've been doing with I've Been Spiked, sort of raising awareness and actually giving people a focus where they can go and actually see different angles to this story and actually mm-hmm. learn a little bit more about the wider aspects of maybe what someone's personal experience has been. It throws into the issue questions around sort of the legalities as well, that this act from 1861, which was designed against sort of poisonings in presumably grand old hotels and boudoirs when people were being dealt poisons for various different reasons. And yet the spiking laws still sit under that offences against the Persons Act of 1861. Now, the government say, well, there's no gap. There's no gap. Everything's covered by that law from 1861. Does the law need to modernise to both take into account the realities of what's happening today, but also to make it absolutely clear that it is an offence? And if you've got a mate who suggests doing it, or you get a hint that someone's doing it, or you see someone doing it, that you are witnessing a crime being committed, as opposed to witnessing a bit of banter, a bit of fun, a bit of, and these are all in quote marks, by the way, a bit of, you know, oh, this is just the sort of stuff we do on a night out. Where do we need to go with that particular angle of it, do you think?
I think modernizing the law and bringing spiking to the forefront and making people realize that this is a serious offense will help when it comes to spiking. I've always been in two minds about, you know, changing the law around spiking, whether that'll make much difference, because as we see at the moment, a lot of cases aren't reaching the courts anyway. I think it would be a good start to change the law, because I think making people realise how serious of an offence it is, highlighting that, will put some people off. But unfortunately, like other serious crimes, it doesn't stop people. I think a lot of different changes need to be made at loads of different levels. And that's kind of why I mentioned before, you know, making testing more readily available so that we are able to catch people when this does happen. Even like, and then rolling out policy across the nighttime industry, you know, that everyone has to adhere to, whether that means that they have to have testing kits behind bars, or, you know, they have some kind of policy so that if someone is spiked on their venue, they know how to handle that. And I know that seems like a lot of it's been placed on the victim in a way, because I'm not saying about, you know, the police doing a better job, but it would be nice to see that as well. It would be great to see the police take this more seriously. And I think they had for a bit. But I don't know. It's kind of, there was a bit of a flash in the pan moment with spiking where they said that they were going to take things more seriously, but it would be good to see longevity in that, because currently it's kind of like a forgotten issue once again. And for someone like me that campaigns against this, it's kind of sad. It's kind of disheartening, you know, getting an email from the Home Office the other day saying that, you know, they're not going to make spiking a law in its own right because they don't think it's necessary. Like, even some of the wording can make it feel like you're just doing all of this for nothing. But I know it's not for nothing. It would be nice to, instead of just talking about what they're going to do, it would be good to actually see some real action, because I'm yet to see any of it. So it would be great to see that in action.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.